because this talk is in English, I think I should introduce Graham Seaman in English too. I'm really glad that we were able to have Graham Seaman here. Graham Seaman is from England. Graham Seaman is the maintainer of a project called Open Collector. Open Collector is a project where they design free digital electronics on both levels, board level and chip level, is it? If I understood you right. And he will talk about the past, present, and future of open hardware design. And since he's from England and since he's a native speaker in English, he may speak a bit too.
I can't speak German. If I speak too fast, just shout at me, slower. I'll try and slow down. I have a problem. When I'm nervous, I speak very fast. So you may have to do a lot of shouting. Okay. So a while ago, Stefan wrote to me and said, can you do a presentation about Open Collector and open hardware design? And so on. Open Collector isn't actually a site where we do designs. It's more of a resource. I have links to other places where people are doing hardware designs, links to software for hardware design purposes, EDA software, electronic design automation software. So, being lazy, I thought, how can I do this? How can I talk about this subject? I don't want to do something very theoretical. I don't want to do something very technical. So I wrote back what I thought was the easy answer. I'll do something descriptive. I'll just describe what's happening, what people are doing with free hardware designs at the moment. Then I discovered that was kind of harder than it sounded. Somebody asked you to describe free software. You've got a lot of individuals writing free software. They're linked in groups, working together. But you can abstract from all that and say they've all got some things in common. You have people writing source code. They take that, they put it through a compiler. And they get an executable program. Maybe occasionally you get somebody who needs to stop halfway through with assembly language and they need to tweak the assembly language. But basically, they're all doing the same thing. They're all writing source code. Secondly, that's programming. That's not free programming. Secondly, you have very clear descriptions of what free software is about. You have an organization, the Free Software Foundation, that's existed for many years, that has a very clear philosophy. Even people who don't agree with the Free Software Foundation's philosophy have clear positions, which you can easily go and find and read. If you try and compare that with free hardware designs, again, you have a mass of hobbyists working at home, building their own boards, making things. You have engineers who in their spare time like to do things they can't do at work. You have students in universities who want to produce something that can actually be used outside. But there is no one single process that you can describe. It's not a question of just create a design and put it through a magic process and out comes a piece of equipment at the other end. The designs are very, very varied. You may have somebody writing in a hardware definition language. You may have somebody drawing schematics. It may be the output is a board. It may be the final stage is a chip. It may be an FPGA. And the route that they get from there to there is likely to have various stops on the way that need manual input. If you're creating a mask that's going to become an IC, then you're not just going to automatically generate that with a compiler, you're probably going to have manual input at each stage. So there isn't a single thing to be covered by a license, the same way there is with software. There are a mix of things to be covered by licenses. Secondly, where's this? Doesn't exist. No free hardware foundation that does the same thing as the free software foundation. So there's no... Could somebody get me some water? Thank you. I've got it right. There's another one. Stefan. Okay. Okay. So I said I was going to give a descriptive talk. So what am I left with? A mass of different people doing different things. I can't really start like that. So I thought, okay, I'll try and create my own definition of what free hardware design is. That's quite hard to do, just thinking in the abstract. So I thought, okay, then I'll start negatively. I'll say what it isn't first, and then try and go from there to what it is. Okay, so starting negatively, free hardware design is not the same as commercial hardware design. So let's try and describe commercial hardware design. The first thing is that unlike software, software is basically protected by copyright law. Sometimes, okay, at the moment people are trying to bring in patent law more, but basically, traditionally, it's been copyright law. You have one law to worry about. Hardware designs, you have a mix. You have copyright law, you have trade secret laws, you have patent law being the most important. You have the Semiconductor Chip Protection Act, which is quite similar to copyright but not identical. So there are a big mix of laws. You're not going to find a single license that covers all those laws that finds you a way to keep a design free. Okay. Commercially, you have no real sharing of designs. You can't build on an older design unless you actually own them yourself. Now, in practice, that's too limiting. So what tends to happen is that the big companies get patents on a large number of designs, and two companies will cross-license the patents to one another so they can use one another's designs. They have access to the pool of designs from a bigger pool, but everybody else is locked out of that. It's a way that the big companies can use to control the market to some extent. It's very hard even for small commercial companies to break into that, whereas the big companies like Texas or IBM can cross-license patents, and it acts as a way of keeping the large companies, the near-monopoly companies, in control of an area. Following on from that, the actual material that you're designing for, if you're designing for chips or if you're designing for FPGAs, the lowest level of that, the actual physical level of that, is usually patented, it's partly secret, and so on. That makes it very hard for anybody except the manufacturers to produce software that you can use to design for those devices. It's possible for those companies to license the information to software companies for them to produce software so that you can get libraries that allow generic software producers to produce designs that work with a specific device. But that makes it very hard for people to produce free software to do the same thing. So EDA software, electronic design automation software, is traditionally extremely expensive. it's very hard for, say, a hobbyist sitting at home to be able to afford. You're dependent on freeware, on the sub-bits of the design software that the companies are happy to let you have for free. Next thing with commercial design practice is generally designs are driven by marketing departments. They're not driven by engineers thinking, hey, that would be a really cool idea, I'd like to make that, I'll go and do it. The engineers are given a decision on what they're going to make from a marketing department. And the marketing department and the sales department have their own goals. In particular, getting that product to market before anybody else. That means the commercial design practice, you tend to have terrible rushes, just as you do with software, where you're working to impossible deadlines that don't let people finish things the way they'd like to, make the overriding goal, usually speed, also secondary goals, make the thing as cheaply as you possibly can. Things like make it repairable don't come into it. In fact, make it repairable is probably a bad idea for a commercial product because then people don't throw them away and buy a new one. Make it easily upgradable doesn't come into it because then people won't throw it away and buy the new version. They'll just upgrade and so on. And finally, the actual users of the end product don't have a right to know how it works. In fact, you're not expected to know how it works. You get a mobile phone, you get your television or whatever. Maybe going back 20, 30 years, it was quite normal to get a schematic when you bought an electronic product. Nowadays, it's very, very rare to get any information at all about it. The combined effect of all these things is that you have a group of designers who know how things work and a massive population who don't know how things work, and there's a complete barrier between the two. And the end users aren't expected to be interested. They're not expected to know. It's like magic.
And even the engineers in one company don't know everything, so they don't make their own company when they leave.
Yes. Yes, the whole industry is completely tied up with generally non-disclosure agreements. If you go and talk to some of the big companies, if you go and talk to them about an idea that you want to propose to a big company, they make you sign a non-disclosure agreement before you go there. You're not allowed to tell anybody else what you've been talking about. And that this whole secrecy aspect, because of the way the laws work, because they're not relying on copyright, they're also relying on trade secret law. The whole thing is completely bound up in secrecy, which makes it quite obvious this is not going to be the way that free hardware designs would work. So taking those points one by one and contrasting them with free hardware designs, this was supposed to come up with a definition of free hardware designs. First one, don't have access to most of the laws. We want to make designs open and shared. It's very hard to use any kind of trade secret law. There are some attempts, people looking at ways that might be used in some way to protect a free design, but it's very difficult to do in any sensible way. Can't use patents, not necessarily because people disapprove of patents, but simply because patents are too expensive. You're doing a free design, you're already giving time, you're giving energy, you're not going to give several thousand pounds as well to pay for a patent. Even the Semiconductor Chip Protection Act, which is based on copyright, you have a registration fee, which you don't have with copyright law. So basically, you're reduced to copyright law. And copyright law is not very strong with hardware designs. It exists, it's there, but there are real arguments about how strongly it protects a design, in the sense that if I take, say, a description of a circuit and write it in the hardware definition language, and somebody else gets that piece of code and draws a schematic from it, which is absolutely identical in function, the copyright has disappeared in the transfer. The copyright is not the copyright of the idea of how the thing works. the copyright covers the expression, the way the thing appears. And if you change the appearance, your copyright's disappeared. So, we're limited to copyright law, but we have real problems with it. Second point, commercial designs are kept secret. Here, obviously, it's the opposite. Designs need to be spread as far as possible. If you're trying to design a new processor or whatever it is, the more people you have helping you, the better, in general, provided they have some idea what they're doing and there's some amount of coordination, then the more widely you can spread it, the better, the more people can test it, the better, and so on, just like with free software. To do that, you really need to have free design software as well. That's something I'll come back to later on. This is a problem. Some free design software exists, not enough yet. People are working on creating free design software, but in my opinion, free hardware design doesn't really exist completely until there is also free design software to go with it. The purposes of the designs. Okay, the marketing department's gone. We can do what we like. The purpose of the designs is totally open. It really depends completely on the individual group, and it can be absolutely anything. There's no way to lay down a law about what it's got to be. It can be to produce something that's completely ecologically sound, or it can be to produce a processor that runs faster than Intel processors. It doesn't matter. It's whatever people want. Finally, if you've got an open design, then obviously people who get the actual end product can know how it works as well. They're going to have access to the designs, just like anybody who wants to cooperate with the design does. There's no secrecy gone, no secrecy there for the end user either. In fact, generally, you would expect that people would, or it's actually happened that people try to make it as easy as possible for the end users to actually modify the design, to actually make their own changes to it. Obviously, there's limits on how much you can do that with different things. If it's a chip, forget it. You can't modify it, not the final produced version. But there are ways to incorporate modifiable sections within designs. Okay. So I'm not saying all these exist. I'm saying this is just an a priori definition of what free hardware design would look like. If it all existed, then what would happen? Well, you're certainly not going to get an entire population interested in doing electronic design. It's going to be a minority thing. It always has been a minority thing. But it's going to be more diffuse than it is at the moment. No, not this absolute separation between people who know everything and the majority who know nothing. You'll have much more of a spread. If it's easier for people to get involved with doing things, with building things, there would be a much larger proportion of the population that knows how to do it. You may not know personally, but you'll know somebody else who does. Secondly, if your designs aren't designed by marketing departments, aren't dictated by marketing departments, then you can actually start producing things that people actually want. Just as with free software, things tend to get written because somebody wants them, because they're useful to somebody. People don't write free software just in the abstract. They write it because it's something they need. If I was better and had more time, I would definitely be writing EDA software because it is just so frustrating not having it. You know, and the same goes for hardware designs as well. People will tend to produce things that are actually useful, not necessarily things that they think they can persuade people to buy more of. Okay, so that's wishful thinking. How real is it? Well, people tend to... You say free hardware design to people, and what they tend to think is, okay, 1984, Free Software Foundation. Free software. 1998, maybe, little baby branch, free hardware designs, very small. In fact, Jan, I think you said something similar to this yesterday. I don't, maybe you, maybe Lionel. free hardware design is about 2 years old or so. I don't know.
Maybe it was created by yourself.
I think free hardware design, some elements of this have been around for a long time. I think maybe since 1970s, early 1970s or so. One of the things I'm going to do is actually eliminate large parts of this because I don't know about it. I'm going to take some of the more important groups. The radio people, who've always been closely linked with free software, is maybe one of the most important aspects of free hardware design, and I don't know about it, so I'm not going to talk about it. That's going to go. I'm going to take all the people into electronics for music, which has been around also for a very long time, so I don't know about it. I'm going to stick to digital stuff, which is the only bit that I know something about. Where's the bit that Open Collector is about? The digital side, really. Okay, so going back to look at history, I'm going to say free digital electronics really started in the 1970s. And it started for two reasons. One was a technological reason, and the other was a social reason. And I think that has applied every time there has been a rebirth of free hardware designs. There are the two things that go together. There is a social side, and there is a technological side. Most of this early stuff is actually based on the States, not because the States is the only place where things happened, but it tended to be where things happened first, and then they spread from. This time round, it seems to be different. I think free hardware design this time is maybe more important in Europe than it is in the States, or certainly as important in Europe and other parts of the world, such as Japan in particular, also third world developing countries. It's starting to become more important. But the beginning is basically talking about the States. The technological side of it is that for the first time you had chips that incorporated a fair number of functions, so you could build something fairly complex by taking a number of chips and plugging them together on very simple boards. You could make single-sided boards at home, double-sided boards at home, Vero board. You could solder things together very easily. They were big components. They were easy to get at. The frequencies were low. You didn't need to worry about radio interference, about induction, inductance, and so on. You could build things with big masses of wires all over the place. It still worked. It didn't matter. So you had a technology that was very nice. It was very easy for individuals to use. You had a lot of people sitting at home as individuals, not necessarily as groups at all, just isolated individuals doing hobbyist stuff. So that's the technological side. The technological side on its own doesn't lead to any kind of movement. It needs a social side as well. And in the States, that side came out of the Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s, the whole community movement of trying to strengthen local communities, to create more ways for local communities to communicate with one another. And at the tail end of the 60s, the attempts to create the first bulletin boards as a way of strengthening local communities. This is very much a West Coast, Berkeley kind of tail end of the hippie movement kind of thing. But there was a pool of people trying to create bulletin board systems as a way of strengthening local communities, of bringing people in communities together in ways that they hadn't been before. So you've got this combination, actually a very strange combination, because at that time there were no personal computers. You're talking about mainframes. So you've got people trying to build communities by bringing in mainframes, or at least large minis, into local communities, especially into sort of poorer areas around Los Angeles and San Francisco, which is a very strange idea. You're talking about taking the, what was then the highest technology and putting it in the poorest areas of the cities. Okay. So you bring in these things from outside. What's going to happen to them? Who's going to know how to look after them, how to run them, how to use them to support a community? Almost nobody. It's not like to be anybody locally. You have to bring in an engineer, somebody to run them, programmers from outside. They're not actually part of the community. It's something external that's been brought in. Okay. So the impulse for changing that, obviously it didn't just come from one person, but it's easier sometimes to talk about one person. And in this case, there was one particular person called Lee Felsenstein, who had a combined background from the Students for a Democratic Society and as an electronic engineer. He was involved in both sides. He had been involved in community newspapers, underground newspapers in the 1960s, and in the 1970s, he got involved with trying to set up these bulletin board systems. And if you read what he wrote about what was happening then, one of the things he keeps mentioning is Ivan Illich and a book that he wrote called Tools for a Convivial Society. I didn't know this book until I kept seeing that Felsenstein was talking about it. I thought, why? I've got to read this thing. It sounds like it's about technology and society and how they relate. I found it incredibly abstract. In fact, this quote I've got here was one of the most concrete things that I could find in it, and it's still abstract. But it's talking about tools being used in different ways, tools either being used to control people or tools being used to enhance what people can do, to be controlled by people. And what Lee Felsenstein's kind of stroke of genius was to take this idea, this very abstract idea, and actually make it quite concrete. So his idea was, we don't want to be bringing people from outside to support the bulletin boards. We'll have local people build their own systems. We'll have them create their own systems, and then they'll know how to look after them. They'll know how to run them, they'll know how to expand them, and so on. The first attempt at this that he made was something called the Tom Swift computer terminal. Didn't even have a processor. We're talking slightly before the widespread availability of the 8008. This was entirely TTL, just individual chips, no processor there at all. I can't actually find a copy of the schematic for that. This is the schematic for a computer he designed, part of a computer he designed slightly afterwards. And his idea was he was going to get people in local communities to build these things. Now, I can imagine this little engineer running down a street waving this big schematic at people saying, here, build this, it'll change your lives. somehow, it didn't quite work. So, the idea was still there, but he needed to find a different way to actually implant this. And the second approach was to say, what we need is groups of people who work together. It's the people we need first, rather than the design. We need to encourage people to actually work together in producing their own designs, rather than me creating a design beforehand and handing it out to people. And the design for the terminal was done, he'd put a lot of thought into how it should be designed, in the sense it was something that could start from a very small base. It was modular. You could add pieces as you went on. You could build up a bigger system as you got happier with it. It was very, very simple. It was easy for beginners to make, and so on. But it didn't do any good, the fact that he'd done all the thinking about it. It wasn't going to create a pool of designers in the outside world. So the next thing was a group of, I think originally five people, and I've lost that. Originally five people, some of them community activists, some of them just engineers. Lee Felsenstein is the one who kind of bridged the gap, who was on both sides, starting something called the Homebrew Computer Club, which if you've read Hackers by Stephen Levy, there's two whole chapters about the whole Home Computer Club in there. It started with five people. First actual meeting they called 30 people. By the end of the year, 600 people. And it spread all across the states very quickly, the whole idea. There were groups like this formed in other cities across practically the whole of the states. From there, I don't know so much about the clubs spreading outside the states, but the actual idea, the things they were doing, were copied outside the states, and it rippled on. It had an effect that went on around the world gradually for quite a few years after it started. And the basic thing was very simple. This is pre-internet. It is pre-ARPANET. The only way you can communicate is actually by physically being together. So you needed the clubs. What people would do was design computers, design bits of computers, bring them in, bring their designs in, bring the things they've made in, hand them round, discuss them, and so on. And since there was no existing computer industry for small computers at the time, they basically were the computer industry. They created the small computer industry from nothing. The first Apple was one of the designs that was brought to the Homebrew Computer Club and discussed, passed around. Absolutely no secrecy. People were encouraged to exchange the things, to trade them, to improve on them, because everybody was an amateur. Everybody was learning. Everybody actually needed the help. So that's something that had a massive effect, first in increasing the number of people who were involved in electronics. Certainly, I was about 5 years after this in England, suddenly aware that there were lots of people I knew who were putting together little computer systems at home, and it seemed like a really cool thing to do. And I didn't know where the ideas had come from, but it definitely, this is where it started. It started from that combination of the technological change making it possible and an actual deliberate social attempt to incorporate the technology and the social side together. It also impacted on the computers that we have now. Some ways, very good ways, in other ways, quite unfortunate. But certainly the style of the first real commercial home computers, when I say the first real ones, the ones that weren't games, the ones that were game computers, the ones that were intended to be office-style computers, the first PCs, the initial one that IBM came out with, in fact, I think the initial two, were closed designs where there was no attempt to be compatible with anything the hobbyists had been doing. There was no way to produce add-on cards to fit into the thing. Everything was kept secret. Nobody bought them. Their market was with these people who actually knew about them because they'd been using them, they'd been creating bits of them, they'd been talking to people about them and so on. And they had no hope with something that was a closed design. The actual IBM PC that came out, I found a quote from the guy who was in charge at the time, the real PC, the one that actually went on to take over the market. And he tried to spin it. It's choice that's the underpinning of IBM's commitment to open architecture. We provide information and specifications which encourage others to develop options and programs that run on our systems. As if this was something IBM is so kind, they chose to do it this way. I think reading interviews with anybody who is involved with the Homebrew Computer Club, that is not what happened. IBM were actually forced to do it that way because it was the only way they could reach the existing market. Unfortunately, in the process, they got lumbered with the 8086 processor family because nearly all the homebrew designs, came through the 4004, 8008 route. So that side of it was a shame. But otherwise, it's shown that people not only... The whole homebrew movement not only affected large numbers of people who were actually interested in electronics, it influenced the big companies as well. It influenced the way that IBM designed at that time. Okay, that kind of died over the 80s as things got harder and harder to do for hobbyists. It got harder and harder to make boards on your own. as frequencies got higher, it got harder to do the designs. As buses got wider and wider with more and more bits, it got harder and harder to make homemade boards that would actually work with modern devices. You ended up going from two layers to multiple layers. You can't make that in a little bowl on your kitchen sink. The devices stopped being things with through pins that you could solder very easily. They have tiny little flat legs on the top of a board, very hard to solder by yourself. The technology changed in such a way it got very hard for the hobbyist to carry on, but some people did. Obviously, this wave finished, but there was still a pool of people left behind who'd had this experience, who'd known the chance of creating their own designs at that time, and who went on working as individuals. Okay. The next example of free hardware design that's existed before now is very slightly later, but an almost completely different set of people. This is now talking about chip design rather than board design. It's much more closely related to free software than it is to free hardware in some ways. In particular, this is the first example that I know of people deliberately going out to choose to use the bizarre method of development rather than sort of traditional top-down design methods, and actually not only using it, but putting it down in writing. This is a way to spread changes. This is a way to get new systems adopted, to spread them out as widely as possible and as freely as possible. Okay, the technological change in this case is with the way chips were designed, the way chips worked. Up until the late 70s, chips had been moderately sized. The people who worked with them were generally physicists who knew the details, the real intimate details of the physics, right down to the lowest level. There wasn't a need for a separation between architects who only knew the functions of the chip and physicists who knew the way the internals of the chip worked. It tended to be one person taking on the whole span of things. By the end of the 70s, that was just getting very, very difficult to do. The chips were getting bigger and bigger. Moore's law was applying. There was a need for new design methods, and there was a need for new design methods that automated things more. Instead of one person actually working out exactly where each transistor went on the chip and what shape the transistor was and all the details involved with that, you needed to make it practical to make chips. You needed to be able to automate the process to some extent. Two people who came up with a way of doing this were Lynn Conway and Carver Mead, the two on the photo there. And they decided that with this change, the only way to make it possible for people to design in this way was to take a new approach to how you let people learn the design. Jan, you're making a very strange face at that picture. No? Oh, okay.
It's not you, I'm sure.
No, nope, definitely not me. Okay. Chip design till then had very nearly always been done within companies. Companies own their own fabrication. They didn't go outside to do it. So you'd have IBM or Motorola or whoever doing design internally, getting the thing made internally as well. To do what they wanted to do, they wanted to make it possible for that stage, the final physical stage of manufacture of the chip, to be done separately. Didn't matter if it was in the same company or outside. They wanted to get large numbers of people who knew the new design method very quickly. That means they needed to make large numbers of chips. You can't train people to make chips without them actually making chips. And that meant they had to have come up with ways of putting multiple chips on one single wafer instead of having thousands of copies of the same chip on one wafer. So they needed large numbers of people working together. They needed to do that, they needed a design method that was simple, that was easy to use, that they could teach quickly. If they're going to get large numbers of people using a new method in a short space of time, the method itself has to be quick. So they abstracted away a lot of the physical details from chip design and left some very, very basic rules that maybe wouldn't give the most efficient design, but would give something that actually worked and was reliable, robust, and easy to learn. Where am I? Okay, where's my next page gone? It's okay. Okay, I've lost an image, but okay. So, simple design rules. Basically, you could do this style of design. You could do with three coloured pencils. So huge numbers of students learnt to do chip design using a red, a green, and a blue pencil, and where the different coloured lines crossed, you had a transistor. For the first time, it was possible to make chip design something generally taught in universities. There was a huge amount of enthusiasm behind this. Universities around the States again first, but then across Europe as well, very quickly adopted this. Electronics departments expanded. Lots and lots and lots of people learned to do chip design. From being something that was known by a small elite of physicists, it became something that was very, very widely known. Only among people within the universities. This is not something that spread outside the universities. But it became still a large number of people who knew how to do this. There was a break with the dependence on being in a big company to get the manufacturing done, because the universities would cooperate till they had enough designs to put the whole lot on one wafer. They'd reduce the cost. They needed standards. If all these people in different universities across the States or across universities within European countries were going to cooperate, they needed standards as well that would allow them to communicate. They couldn't have a one-off system that was only usable within one country. And they needed software to support the new design method as well. At first, the software was quite basic, but it grew very quickly in complexity as people realised that you could start actually doing real automation based on this. So you had, at first, software that's just used for actual layout. Where do things go on the chip? The classic one being Magic, which is still around now, which is under Berkeley license, because most of this came from Berkeley. And Berkeley traditionally have put their software under free licenses. And through the 80s, nearly all the chip design software that came from the Mead and Conway approach was under free licenses, and most of it has stayed under free licenses. Chipmunk, which is descended from the particular piece that Mead and Conway themselves used, is now under the GPL, which I think shows their particular intentions with this. They really deliberately, the paper, Lynn Conway afterwards wrote a paper about how they'd done this, the social engineering involved, how to make this process, how they'd made the process open, made standards emerge from the fact that people were actually sharing and cooperating with one another, how they'd managed to spread the software by making sure that it could be given to as many people as possible, and making sure that they had a feedback process where people complained that bits of the software weren't working right, it would get changed, it would get improved on. It was literally the whole bizarre process invented sometime around 1978. Before the internet, they were actually using the ARPANET to start with, and then the internet very soon afterwards. From there, went on to much more complex design minimization software, which is very, very hard. It involves very difficult algorithms. It tends to be completely non-linear problems, which are quite difficult to solve. The rules exist, but they're just horribly complicated. So things like SIS and Espresso for logic minimization. For many, many years, Espresso was the best program for logic minimization, and it was a free program. It still is a free program. In Stanford, you'd got Olympus as a synthesis system, also free, still available. across from the States into Europe. You've got the University of Delft, quite heavily involved with this. Although the actual design techniques they were using were different, they also produced their software as free software. So for a whole period, mid to late 80s, the actual state-of-the-art electronic design automation software was actually free software. That software is still free software, but it's now very old free software, unfortunately. What happened in the meantime was that the way universities were funded changed. And from in the 1980s, universities had been doing this work, then giving the results to companies, cooperating with companies who had used the software. If you look now at almost any electronic design automation software, you will find bits of this software in there still. There is an internal format called BLIF, used by the SIS and Espresso tools. You look inside almost any modern EDA package, you will find little converters. There will be a BLIF to my particular package converter, and vice versa, and so on. There are bits of this software everywhere, but that has been privatized. The improvements that were made to the original have been made private, very, very expensive software. And from the 1980s on, from the end of the 1980s, the way the universities were funded changed so that they got the funding for cooperating with a company. Rather than doing the work and then cooperating with a company, they would get a company come in, they would do something with the company under non-disclosure agreement from the start. And on the occasions where they didn't, then they'd be planning to sell the software to actually make money for it themselves. In either case, it wasn't going to be open source anymore. And because of the, although this had been a very open process, it had been contained within the universities, there was no pool of developers outside the universities to carry on the work. Now it's restarting. The next version of MAGIC, after a very, very long gap, is now being worked on. But it's taken a long time for it to come back again. So, end of the 80s, early 90s, at least for me, it felt like this is the dark ages. You can't make realistic boards anymore. The hobbyists tended to be trying to recreate the little machines of the early 1980s. There was a kind of nostalgia electronics around a lot. There was no hope whatsoever of working with chip design unless you were in a very big university to start with. There was no visible kind of free movement in any sense, in any area of electronics that I was aware of. There may have been things going on, maybe with PIC micros, I don't know, around that time. But it seemed like a fairly dead period until about 2 or 3 years ago, when things suddenly started changing again. Okay, so I've said these things happen when there's two things. There's a technological change and there's a social change. So what's the technological change this time? It's not so much, it's one of those things with quantity suddenly giving you a qualitative change. It's an increase in size. It's not something radically new in itself. It's the way that chips have increased in size so dramatically over the last few years. And that has led to it being very difficult for companies to produce designs, given the limited time to market that they have, completely from scratch that will fill up something with such a large area. If you've got a single chip that's going to take two processors, a bunch of peripherals and other things on it, then the odds are you're going to want to take existing designs and stick them together. Okay, then you need to design some interconnection for it, but basically you're taking existing... it's easier for companies if they can take pre-existing designs and combine them to get products completed in the time. So you had the beginnings of a commercial market in actual designs free from physical implementation. It wasn't very successful at all, but around 98 you started to see the first companies trying to just sell designs for systems on chip without any idea of that company themselves doing any manufacture. It wasn't successful for a number of reasons. In particular, I think that the companies do not trust one another. And how do you protect trade secrets when designs are put in a place where other people can buy them? What's to stop somebody else looking at them, deciding, I'm not paying any money for that, but I'm going to take all the ideas, thank you very much. So it wasn't, that in itself wasn't massively successful, but it was a sign of something changing. That increase in size also affected field programmable gate arrays. You've had programmable logic around for a long time, but it's been only very recently that it's been of the size where you can put really large designs in programmable logic, not just things that are duplicates of small designs you can create in other ways, but actual reasonable sized pieces, like, say, a Spark processor. You want to fit a Spark processor into a field programmable gate array, you can. It's not going to run very fast, but it's perfectly possible to do, and it has been done. So you can put large enough designs to be interesting, to actually enthuse people. If you tell people, yes, you can work on something that is as up-to-date and as large as the things the big companies are doing, and you can do it just by using a field programmable gate array, you have found part of a way around this manufacture problem. How do hobbyists, how do people without access to the big factories make things themselves? So that's technological changes. The social changes, the big change, obviously, is free software. Free software has become so large and so visible, it's obviously an inspiration to anybody else trying to do anything of any sort that is designed to be free and to be shared. So you've got free software at one extreme. The other end, you've also got the imposition of horrendous rules for copyright and patent and so on the developing world. And you have, I think, something that you'll be seeing a lot more of in the next few years, pressure on the people in the developing world to use free designs, the same way there's pressure on them to use free software. That has already started to some extent, but I think that is another thing that is going to get bigger. Am I talking too fast? No. Am I taking too long? I've realised I'm over an hour. But now I'm on the present, so I guess. I didn't mean to spend so long on the history. It was supposed to be quite short. Okay, if I need to stop, can you give me 5 minutes warning or something?
No, we want to have a discussion.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to you at about 20 minutes.
Okay, yeah, fine, yeah. Okay, so looking at what's happening now, I'm going to take it broken down to some extent by those categories. First, increase in size of ICs and the possibility of putting whole systems on a single chip. That creates the possibility of creating designs that are just aimed to do that, to be put together as building blocks within chips. And the commercial sites to do this, they do exist. People were, I think, hoping to make a lot of money from them a couple of years ago, and that didn't happen. They do still exist, though, and maybe they'll be more successful in the future. On the other hand, the free design groups that are working in this area have a lot of advantages. They have the possibility of collaborating with one another. They actually, most of the time, will want to collaborate with one another. They want to keep everything open. They have no pressure to keep secrets from one another. So a lot of the things that damage the commercial companies trying this approach actually work in the favour of free groups trying this approach. The first one was a group called Free IP, which was pretty much based around one person who was a professional designer and decided to start making his own designs open source. Things like the first one that he did, I think, was a 6502, which is old enough that it's not covered by patents anymore, but the design for the 6502 processor, and then some, maybe half a dozen of these designs of very good quality, which have now been manufactured. Once you start designing this way, you're not the one who worries about how they get made. If somebody else makes them, provided they give you some feedback on what changes they've had to make, you get a debugging process going on there. It's kind of slow, compared with software, but it's there. You get designs that will gradually improve. Now the group that's by far the largest is called Open Cores. Open Cores is based in University of Ljubljana, and originally came from students in Ljubljana, but it's now way bigger than that. They have people collaborating with them from German companies. They have students in Indonesian universities who are using it to help with as a way of creating realistic research projects. They have American designers. There's a real mix of people working with this. Their aim is to produce a complete library of components for systems on chips. One of the problems with that is you can create separate components. How do you know the separate components are going to interact well with one another? So they needed to standardize on some kind of bus. It's another problem. The commercial companies couldn't do this. They couldn't sort out a bus that they would all agree on. Everybody wants, every large company wants the bus, the standard bus, to be their own bus. And lately, because open source is very trendy, the large companies tend to say, use our bus and we'll make it open source as well. But not quite. There's always a few catches in the license somewhere. But it's an open source one, so everybody should use it. So there is actually, if you look at commercial sites at the moment, there is a lot of stuff that is nominally open source, including EDA software. And mostly, not entirely, but mostly you find it's bits of things that you can't use without becoming dependent on the other things that that particular manufacturer produces. Not all. Some of IBM's software for board design seems to be quite genuinely free. Maybe some of one or two other companies, but in general, the biggest companies that have made things open source, it doesn't seem to be very genuine. But in this case, there was a very small company that was in the same situation of having a bus designed and wanting to make it widely used, wanting to make theirs become the standard. They didn't have the leverage of the big companies, so their idea was donate it to Open Cores. So they gave their bus design to Open Cores as a completely public domain, bus. Since then, they've had a whole bunch of engineers from other places working on it. There's been changes made to the original that the company Silicore designed originally. It seems to be working well for everybody. So I think there is a real chance that this bus may actually become a standard, actually outside the purely free design, open source area. As far as manufacture goes, the Open Cores, one of the first things the Open Cores group produced was a processor which was running on an FPGA only. Some of their designs have been implemented on FPGAs. As far as I know, they haven't yet got to the point of implementing anything or having anything implemented on an IC. They say there's been at least one company that has some interest as a kind of publicity thing, pardon me, to get the designs, some of the designs manufactured. Another group, which is rather exceptional because it has very, very big backing, is the European Space Agency. The European Space Agency have put their designs for the Spark processor and will be putting some of their other designs that they're working on, a CAN bus design, under the GPL. These are VHDL-based designs. The Free Software Foundation has agreed that it will back VHDL-based designs as defendable under copyright law. Those designs have been manufactured, so there are GPL chips in existence. Three different foundries have manufactured GPL Spark processors now. So GPL chips do exist. Having said that, it's rather exceptional. Not every group is part of the European Space Agency. It's kind of a big group to be involved with. And I'm sure they could have had the things manufactured in other ways if they'd chosen to. But they decided to put it under the GPL. Okay, next thing, field programmable gate arrays. Can't really pick on one group that's working with field programmable gate arrays. They're something that virtually any group can use, so almost any example I give is going to be a bit random. What field programmable gate arrays do mean, in particular, is that you have a route through the test cycle. You write some software, you compile it, it doesn't work, you go back, you change bits, you recompile, you use your debugger, whatever, you have a very fast loop. The problem with hardware design tends to be you do your design, you send it away for manufacture, some weeks later something comes back, it doesn't work, you look at it, you find out why, you send it off again for manufacture, each time paying out large amounts of money, so you have a very slow, very expensive loop. Field programmable gate arrays give people a partial way round that. So if you're amateurs, if you're small groups, if you're hobbyists working on designs, and you can download a design into a field programmable gate array, you can test it almost as quickly as you can test software. So you have partially got rid of that particular problem. Another problem is, I said I'd take a random example here. There's a little group in France who are interested. Originally, they wanted to redesign one of the Amstrad computers from the 1980s. It was one of the kind of nostalgia efforts. It's changed a bit now, and I think what they're trying to do is design a very cheap computer based on a reasonably fast Z80 processor that will be kind of somewhere between a PC and a palm top kind of in power, but allow them to experiment with things. They don't really know, I don't think they really know exactly what they want to do with this yet, but one of the things they wanted in there was some way of handling the graphics. And since they're originally basing this on the original Amstrad 1980s machine, that had an uncommitted logic array built into it to handle the graphics. Nobody then could duplicate that. Now you can take an FPGA, you can put that in there. You decide you want to improve on it, hopefully you can improve on it as you go along once you have your clone stage working. The last time I saw a mail from them, they were talking about leaving half of it empty and trying to work out what things they'd like to put in there afterwards as they go along. So this is something that become field programmable gate arrays have enabled people to do things that they weren't doing before. Although there's no one group that is the field programmable gate array group. Another thing that has really taken off and is very, very scattered, the thing to do in the 1980s was go away and design, or late 1970s, was design your own computer. A few people designed their own processors. People used bit slice chips where you could build up gradually wider and wider processors by using these components called bit slice components. Now you can design a processor, put it in an FPGA. Lots of people are designing processors. It's kind of the way for everybody to start. You want to get into this kind of electronics at the moment, it's go and show people, look, I've designed my own processor. It's open source. Here, would you like a copy? The next stage beyond that is obviously I've designed my own processor and I'm running Linux on it, which is also quite widely done. This is talking about the next area, actually something I missed a bit in the technology bit. I think there was a period when there were large computers, there were things like PCs, or there were very old home computers like Spectrums or whatever. There wasn't much in the middle. At the moment, there's a real rebirth of computers of every size. Embedded systems in general have got much more important over the last few years. The market for embedded systems is much bigger. Again, it's possible for people to do things that are real and interesting without having to necessarily compete with Dell or the PC manufacturer. There are a whole range of scales they can work on. So at the moment, there are quite a few boards running Linux. The LART, for example, which again, I think it's from Delft. There's a group in Delft. There's also an Australian version of this. Called the Pleb, runs Debian Linux on a strong ARM CPU, single board. The license is almost completely public domain. I think it's one of those licenses. You must reproduce my name on this if you circulate the design, and that's it. No other conditions. Originally designed for radio applications, but people seem to be finding lots of other uses for it. There are a lot of other boards now running Linux. It is not too hard to design a board running Linux. And it's not too, it's not unknown now for people to be designing boards with FPGAs with their own processor design running Linux. Although I don't know if anybody has the whole thing running. There are people definitely working that way. Okay. There's a Japanese group producing a small computer called Morphe 1. It's actually a palm top, but they've decided to include an uncommitted CPLD in that so that users who want to modify it can do. I don't know how this is going to work. I haven't seen the schematics for it yet. I find it quite hard to imagine how they don't tie the pins down to particular functions. How do you put something generic in there? But it's an interesting idea. There is a Brazilian group who are talking about doing something similar, of producing a computer which will have some standard drivers on it. It will have a hard disk interface in conventional logic, but the bulk of the board will be field programmable gate arrays. People put their own designs in there. That's something that people are talking about, not making, maybe it'll never happen. But it's the kind of area where there is a lot of interest in producing things that people can modify themselves. There is also a kind of SourceForge equivalent site. Actually, I don't know if this is something that Marcus from OpenCars, he was talking about creating a SourceForge for hardware. This is rather different because this is SourceForge for electronic designs, but I don't know if there might be common elements between this and the mechanical design stuff that he needs to do. They're trying to put more emphasis on documentation as opposed to just source code and so on. They wanted to produce something that people in poor villages could use, so not everybody is going to have one. So it's got to be shared. It's a computer to be passed around between people. You take turns using it. So how do you cope with that? They've got a smart card. So the idea is individual people have smart cards, which they plug in. So when it's your turn to use the computer, you've got some backup on what you were doing before. If you were trying to use the internet to get a bank loan or whatever it was, you can reload your data from before. Very robust, no separate hard drive there, no components that are easily broken. So it's a design that they couldn't have bought off the shelf from an existing manufacturer. It's something that is very definitely aimed at a particular set of conditions. They chose to create a license which is based on the GPL but tries to also combine that with trade secrets for this. They want it made as widely as possible, but they want improvements to the design to be returned to them. It's a collaboration between the University of Bangalore and a small local company who are actually doing the design work. There's not very many of them. The more widely it can be used, the more people look at it, the more people make it, play around with it, the more likely it is they'll get improvements to the design. So from their point of view, it makes sense to do it this way around, to actually open source the hardware. Obviously, the software is also open source, and they want people to help them with the software. Although the bulk of this is not just a this is working prototypes. This is not just mock-ups. I think they've manufactured 10 so far. They have a contract, I believe, with a company in Madagascar that's going to do the first large-scale manufacturing. There are a number of other designs along similar lines. People in MIT have been trying to design an ultra-low-cost system, minimal power consumption, maybe even with wind-up for places without batteries. The Brazilian government has announced it's going to fund a low-cost community-based, community-style computer. At the moment, it seems like the design is coming top-down. It's not going to be an open-source design, but they're still discussing it. It may yet be an open-source design. Their design is very old-fashioned. It's kind of a cut-down PC, basically. Not old-fashioned, unimaginative, I think. They've just taken a standard PC and said, well, what can we throw away to keep the cost down, rather than the Indian one, which has definitely taken a lot of thought about how this is going to be used. Okay, so future, there are obviously a large number of problems to be solved, and I'm going to have very little time to talk about them. 5 minutes? Okay. The three main problems that I think need to be solved. First, lack of EDA software. people are working on this, but designers tend to be impatient people who want to get on with actually doing something. They don't want to sit around while somebody is offering them buggy software and saying, please test this for me, it might work. They want to concentrate on debugging the design, not the software. So what is unfortunately happening at the moment is, to my knowledge, all the free hardware groups are working with commercial software, not free software. Ironically, some companies are now starting to work with the free software. The free software is getting good enough to be used in some places. Most of the free software development is happening around a group called GEDA, who are a group which are partly they are producing their own software, but also they have a mailing list which has become the mailing list used by people who work on a lot of other free software. So Icarus Verilog, which is maybe the best free Verilog compiler at the moment, share the mailing list with GEDA. Savant, which is the only VHDL, free VHDL compiler, share the mailing list, or at least, not exactly share it, but you know, people talk, they all the groups talk to one another via this mailing list. The big problem with the software is the back end. I think it won't take very long before people have the front end, the initial design, the logic minimization and so on sorted out. The problem is as you get closer and closer to the actual physical hardware, the FPGAs, the details of the internals of FPGAs are secret. So you can't write software, you can't write free software which will give you a chain all the way down from your initial design into the actual bits that go into the FPGA. Similarly with ICs, you're dependent on having access to the libraries, the actual cell libraries that reflect the physical structure of the ICs that you're trying to make. So there's a problem with how far through free software can go, but at least the front part of the chain, there are people working on it, it will get there. The other possibility is, if FPGAs are so secret, design your own and then make chips. That is something that lots of people have suggested. Nobody has had the courage to try it until very recently. One of the open cores people has just started on a design for an FPGA. I think it's very, very early. It'll take a long time before this gets very far. And also it's an area that is very, very heavily defended by patents. And it may be that it's never going to be possible to have anything manufactured because of the patent situation. Maybe ways around this. I've been looking at designs that were done in Russia in the late 1970s, which are quite different from the standard ones used here, where they were patented. The patents have expired. The problem with American patents is that they can extend them. So, for example, Texas Instruments, I believe, made something like £1.5 billion last year on patents from chips that were invented first widespread in the early 1970s. They're still making a fortune on, because American patents just go on forever. They just have to show they've made some improvement to the original design. They get an automatic extension. Okay, next problem, manufacture. I've talked a bit about manufacture. It's the first thing everybody says, if you talk about free hardware design, they go, oh, but you can't make it. It's not true. As I said, there are now GPL processors actually around in physical existence. There are things like the Simputer. There are lots of physical pieces of hardware around. This objection, basically, it's not easy, it's not straightforward. I think there may come a time when people start looking back at how Mead and Conway organized the first multi-chip wafers and saying, can we do that with free designs to make our chips? That hasn't come yet. Maybe that time will come. Definitely, there's going to be to produce large-scale, expensive things like chips, if it happens without just relying on commercial companies doing it for you, it's going to take a lot of cooperation between groups. Things like OpenH, which specializes in embedded systems, the SourceForge-based one, or OpenCores, which has a very open CVS-based system, may be part of that route, encouraging the different subgroups to cooperate with one another. Okay, final problem, licenses. Licenses are a real problem. As I said at the beginning, there isn't one single thing to license. There are a whole mass of things to license. if you put your copyright protection on this, you use the GPL for the HDL description, what happens to this end of things? It's not automatically covered. You have separate licenses for each bit. You have boards, you have all different kinds of things that... It's very difficult to come up with a single copyright-based law, which is a copyright-based license, which will cover all those different aspects at once. And it's very difficult to come up with something that lawyers will tell you will actually work. I'd be very interested to see what happens with the Simputer license, because it's the only attempted hardware license that is actually written by a lawyer. All the others have been written by people saying, let's copy the GPL. I've tried it as well. It's very difficult to do, and you have no guarantee at all that it works. This one is written by a lawyer. I think there are still problems, because there are logical problems with the whole idea of how to protect a design by copyright. The big problem with patents, of course, is you can protect your design with copyright, then go and try and manufacture something and find that you get sued for patent breach as soon as you manufacture it. They don't necessarily care if you have a design on your web page or somewhere, because you're not making it. It might be a complete copy. It could be a scan of their patent application. I think you can still legally put it on your web page because they published it as a patent. But you go and make it, it's something else. So there may be real problems for open source hardware groups, free hardware design groups, when it comes to manufacture, if it ever gets to any scale. Personally, I think it's unlikely. I think it's going to stay small enough for quite a long time. It would have to be amazingly successful in a very short time for the big companies to be worried about it. But it may happen. So there may be problems with people getting sued, in which case this becomes a very, very expensive thing to do. What next? It doesn't really matter, even if none of that lot gets sorted out. Say there's no EDA software, no more EDA software created, nobody sorts out the license problem. There are still a lot of things that have been achieved already, and it looks like there are a lot of things that really are unstoppable now. The creation of widely available free platforms for Linux. It is certainly, if you really want to run your free software on free hardware, you can do it now. It'll take a bit of effort from you, but you can do it now. Over the next year or two, it's going to get to be quite easy to do that. It's not going to be going into the local shop and buying the box. It's going to take more work than that, but it is certainly perfectly practical to do that already. Free processors, designs that outperform commercial ones, the Freedom CPU is going that way, maybe. Over the next year, there will actually be free processor designs that are better than the commercial ones. What?
A free manual.
All right. There will be manuals for free designs that might outperform commercial ones. But at least there is the ambition to try and create something that is good or better, preferably better than commercial designs. Not what there was a few years ago, the ambition to try and recreate something from the 1980s. Now the ambition is to do better than the big companies do. Sorry? Okay. Free designers can design things they want to do. There are some things that the companies don't care about. Open FPGAs. There was an open FPGA, open in the sense that you didn't need a secret bitstream to program it. You could write directly to any location on the chip. You could address it directly. The secrecy was not there. It's perfectly possible to design an FPGA without secrecy, without any effort to make it free at all. It's just its structure would be open. That existed. There's a Scottish guy who designed it originally as a student, started a company to make it, made it quite successfully, got bought by the biggest FPGA company, which produced it for 2 years and then stopped it. So now there are no others, and they own the patents on it. So you find a way to do it, it's got to be a different way, because they've bought the patents on open FPGAs. But I'm sure it's something that people will try. Another thing that people keep saying is compression formats. You have Ogg Vorbis as a free replacement for MP3s. Where's my Ogg Vorbis player? I haven't seen anybody doing this yet, but I'm very sure that there is somebody doing it somewhere that I don't know about, and that you're going to hear about it soon. There will be free design replacements for MP3 players that do Ogg Vorbis instead of MP3. And finally, markets that commercial designers don't really care about because there's no margin in there. The whole very large part of Africa, large parts of India, there is not enough money to be made by conventional manufacturers. They need free designs. I think you'll see increasing collaboration between people here and people in the developing world, recycling one another's designs and creating a pool that really does create something that's global, that goes back to Lee Felsenstein's original ideas of creating tools that are convivial, that enhance communication, but that also enable people to do things that they couldn't do before, and that spread the knowledge of how it works and how to improve it. Oh, sorry, this sentence is running on. I've been talking too long. I stop. Okay, thank you. Talk for 1 hour and 40 minutes. I'm sorry for talking. Oh, I'm sorry I talked so long.
You thought it would be shorter.
I thought it would be a lot shorter. That's why the history bit went on for so long, because I thought, I have to make this last a bit. Mistake. Okay. Any questions or anything anybody wants to talk about? I think maybe if people ask the questions in German and if I don't understand, you translate for me.
Can I ask you? Well, I'm a bit exhausted.
I'm one third on the third part of the letter, but on the other hand, I'm not really used to this particular term, so I don't know.
Well, everything's set.
Did I get it right that there's no actual open FPGA design which is possible to manufacture?
There is none. To my knowledge, there is one open design that has been manufactured. That one can no longer be made, except by Xilinx, who own the rights to it. However, if you come up with a different design, one, you find a different way of doing it, then yes. I don't know how broad the patent is. Xilinx's patents on FPGAs in general are very, very broad because they were involved from very early on among the first FPGAs, and they bought one of the first companies that had done any programmable logic design work as well. So they have some very basic patents on the whole thing. The FPGA world has two very big companies and then four or five smaller ones. The two biggest are Xilinx, which is the Intel of FPGAs, and Altera, which is the AMD of FPGAs. Xilinx has just won a court case on patent grounds against Altera for making FPGAs, basically. Obviously, that would mean that Altera stops manufacturing, but Altera have now appealed. So they have this cycle of, we sue you, you appeal, we see who it costs the most. Eventually, one of us will give up and say, okay, we'll give you something if you stop suing us, if you allow us to carry on. It's all politics, it's not really. The whole of the patent game with the big companies is just politics. So maybe if you can find ways to play the politics a bit with the open source things, there are ways that you can stay out of trouble. I don't know. If Xilinx thought that you were not in any way, I don't think that Xilinx would see somebody producing an open FPGA as actual competition for them anyway. They're too big.
Because the data streams usually has to be encrypted, because the IP menu, the people who make the design in the, yeah, the chip want to be protected. And that is why there is a strong difference between open FPGA and existing FPGA.
Yeah.
But the problem is in the inner working, not in the encryption.
Yeah.
And there are not many ways to make your FPGA. That's the problem.
Thank you. I agree with everything you said.
I have two questions. The first one, the first one concerning efficiency trade-offs between FPGA designs and in ASIC implemented ones. So, since this is a second question, if there would be an open FPGA, then there would be no copyright problems for any core design, since then you just sell the hardware without the design and you boot the core afterwards. And the first question is, as I understood right, there are two different paradigms in programming FPGAs. So first you can just emulate a fixed structure and then write programs for this. And the other one is to try to implement the algorithm in hardware during the program will adapt the structures on the fly. And this would be something to get efficiency trade-off away. Yeah.
FPGAs will always be slower than ASICs because they're based on static RAM. You have an extra layer of logic between you and the physical hardware. They will always be slower. A design on an FPGA will always take up more area as well. But that may not be so much of a problem at the moment, just because there is so much area that if there's more than you need, if you can put bigger devices than you actually need to put into something, it doesn't matter if you're using up a slightly bigger area than you could have done otherwise. But speed will always be a problem. As far as speeding up, processes by using FPGAs goes, yes, it's the same as any parallel programming problem. If you have an algorithm which is parallelizable, then you can speed it up, but some algorithms aren't. Some algorithms are inherently sequential or have large sequential bottlenecks. If you have an algorithm that you can convert to a parallel form, then yes, it's very likely that you can run it, you can make it run faster in an FPGA than, say, in a processor. You can make some image processing algorithms run faster in an FPGA than in the fastest single processor that you can get. Not because the clock rate of the FPGA is high, but because you can run it very efficiently in a parallel form. Of course, if you took the same algorithm and put it in an ASIC, then it would run faster than the FPGA as well. So it's not an absolute thing. There is always a trade-off. My feeling is that it is always very algorithm dependent. Sometimes you have that possibility of outperforming processors, sometimes you don't. As for the question about the fixed structure, is that the question about the fifth? All right. So, yeah. As far as, do you want numbers? I can't really give you numbers on speed up. It changes too fast. An order of what? An order 10? Orders of magnitude in clock rates between ASIC and FPGA.
10 to 11.
Yeah, about 10 times slower than an ASIC.
Okay, there was a question from Patrick.
Can you tell about the intention of the people who built this chip designs, or this? Is it a more political intention to make free information of chip design, or is it more a game with soft and hardware, or? But what? Because I can't believe that we need these chips for to speed up our computers, or I think it's not the intention. No? So what is behind the idea behind this to do this? That would be interesting for me. Yeah?
First, I'm not in that group, so I can't speak as a representative.
It's only an impression. I don't think, I'm almost certain there is no strong political reason behind it, apart from a general belief in the whole free is better than not free philosophy that comes with GNU software generally. And it's the spread of that. As to why people actually do it, I think there are very different reasons depending on the individual. Some of the people doing it are students. They have to do projects. This is a way of doing a project that actually relates to things that other people want, that it's not so artificial anymore. Okay? Some of the people doing it are engineers who have to work on different things at work when that is what they really want to do. Okay, no motivation outside, but that's what they want to do. So that's the reason. Some of the people involved are people like the Silicores company who donated the bus that I talked to originally. They have a commercial motivation where they think that it can help their particular bus to spread, which will give them a commercial advantage. So I think it's a real mix of different reasons for different people. I don't think there is a very strong single theme apart from.
There's a theory behind that to keep that information free or being open.
Yeah.
It's not. It's more playing with the technology, you know, trying out.
Right. I really can't. For myself personally, yes, if it's not fun to do, then why do it? There has to be a larger element of this is enjoyable to do or forget it. I do work at work. I don't want to do work in my own time as well. I want to do something I enjoy in my own time.
The other reason not to do it is for money, you know. because we have to live as engineers, and we have to make things proprietary in order to make free things. That's the compromise.
I think it's also you're sometimes fed up. I'm an engineer, and you're sometimes fed up with don't have standards. You just have to invent the wheel more than
yeah.
once.
Yes. Yes.
That's
because another firm has some patent or something like this on this. And if you have standards, you don't have to take so much time to reinvent the wheel.
However, yeah. Standards can be Trojan horses. For example, the CD-ROM standard. And the DVD now are made by companies who make a reunion and say, well, I put my patent, will you accept it, etc. They gather patents, and then on each CD-ROM made, they ask for money because they made a standard made from patents.
Yeah.
And that is one reason why there is a problem with GDEC, SDROM, Trojan now. And we must be very careful about even standards. Standards unify things, but can lock things too.
But standards.
Standards come out. Anything that's done that's open source tends to generate standards, whether it's the way the internet works, or whether it's software, or whether it's hardware. And when open source things generate standards, they're always good standards. They may be bad technically originally, but they improve. But there is never that locking effect that you're describing. It always makes things better. It always enables people to do more without reinventing the wheel. It enables people to cooperate. And I think that's very much the same, whether it's hardware or software.
Well,
I have a question.
Last question that I asked you, maybe you had time to find the answer. Now that the Pandora box is open, what now?
This is a very broad question. Stefan, I think you should answer this question.
Well,
it's philosophical more than technical.
I've been rather impressed
by also the insights you give, and maybe by seeing the past, we can have an idea of the future, maybe. Mm. So what do you feel?
I think in the past things have come out of hobbyists working together, something has emerged. It's like there's always hobbyists doing stuff. It's like there's a continuous background of noise, and that sometimes there's a signal that comes above that. You know, you see something coherent that emerges from that, where there is some kind of big push of a lot of people working together. In the past, it's come and gone as the technology's gone. When the technology stops making it so easy to do, that signal has died away, and you just have the background, the people who will always be doing things because that's what they like to do, but not together because there's no direction. This time, I think, based on the way that free software has actually survived, free software could have done that. It could have come, it could have gone. There could have been, say, BSD, end of BSD, but there isn't. There's Linux, there's the whole free software movement, and it's a permanent thing. I think this time, maybe there's a possibility that with hardware design as well, there will be a permanent thing that stays after this. And if it stays, then, yes, if it stays, then really we can start talking seriously about the utopian things, about doing things, creating things that are really useful, things that are done well, things that are done well, the way they should have been done in the first place, things that don't exist now because it's not profitable to make them, all those things, then that really becomes possible. At the moment, I think, realistically, it's in the halfway stage. It may stay, I think it will, but it's a question of how long and so on. It's just grown incredibly. In the last two years ago, I started trying to... I thought, logically, there's free software, there should be free hardware. I started trying to make a link page of anything that I could find. There were a lot of hobbyist pages that had been around for a long time. I could kind of pretend, okay, that's free hardware. There were one or two groups trying to do things, mostly just talking, not actually doing anything. And I thought, okay, I'll try and start a website around this. Maybe, I think this will come if there's more communication between people, if people see the few people that there are there doing things. In fact, I was completely wrong. It was just ready to explode. The groups that I talked about today, maybe 10, 15 names of groups that I mentioned there, they're a fraction of the total groups around. There are people all over the place in every country. One of the things that really impresses me is how international this is from the beginning. It's very strong in Japan. There are people in South Africa. There is a Simputa group in India. People wrote to me a short time ago saying, we want to start trying to build up similar work in Russia. The other times it was very much American. This time, this is worldwide from the start, and it is just growing very, very fast, and if it carries on growing at this rate, then there's no problem. It will be permanent.
5 years. 5 years until the revolution.
Well, yeah.
The revolution. You could have a slightly different MP3 player.
Okay, well... I'm interested in who the people are who are working in such free hardware groups. Especially, are they mainly, or is there a good part of engineers which are working professional in this area, or there are more hobbyists?
It's hard to weigh numbers against importance. I think numerically maybe there are more hobbyists, but in terms of the key people...
Do engineers get into this kind of stuff?
Yes.
Yes.
Definitely. Yes, there's one.
I think that's a new freedom. People can design their own hardware. My question is, do the people use this freedom for rethinking also the old concept of computer, the old the von Neumann computer, maybe we can think, do they rethink this? Maybe that there are many, many new concepts thought about parallel computers, analog computers, and do they think about these concepts and do they work with this and experiment with this, these people who design free hardware? Because this would be the really interesting option they could use, because the other way is the big path. There's I think not much to do anymore.
If you're talking about software, I think nobody wants to design the world's 5,010th word processor unless they've been set it as a homework exercise. Right? You want to do software, you want to do something new, you want to be the first one to write something that does something. It's exactly the same with hardware. Why should it be different? Why should anybody want to repeat something that's done? People want to do something new.
That is even the reason why it is interesting to have a free hardware cores that can be reused, so it removes the hassle of rewriting always the same thing and possibly with errors.
We are 3 minutes to 7 o'clock, and I'll take this opportunity to close this talk, and I'm very thankful for you, Graham, to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other electronic groups, free hardware, so especially for energy electronics or something like that, movement electronics, since if you want to do something, for example, ecological or something like that, like that you want to have an open car, you always have to have these power electronics too.
Yes. I'm trying to think. Specifically power.
Power conversion and all this kind of stuff.
I can find people, I'm sure. Can you give me an email address?
Yeah, maybe you put it on your website.
Yeah, there may well be something already. Look at the website, you may find something.
Mm.
Because most of it is just a big list, really. But even if you don't, I can think of maybe people I can talk to who've said similar things to me before, and I don't know if they're doing something, but they might be.
Yeah, that would be nice. I can give you my address. I think it would be very nice if it's a... So in power electronics, the way is the opposite. You don't have this high complex things, but you have to have layouts and something like that. Everything is it's possible to buy everything quite cheap, the power electronics, the involved chips.
Not always. No, I'm making a face because I had a conversation with a Russian engineer a short time ago who told me the biggest single improvement that could be made in Russia now was widespread availability of cheap power control devices to control the heating systems
because
they weigh so much.
Yeah.
But apparently it's not. They have real shortages, so they're not cheap enough, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it would be interesting to have this.
Yeah.
And also in a kind of modularized way, that you have also standard interconnections or something like that.
Yeah.
This is one. And the second thing I'm thinking of, how it's possible to produce all these things.
Yes.
Since my idea would be that if you have design and the core group is thinks okay, it's finished, it's good enough, then you can just make an offer to buy it, and you just produce it if you have enough buyers. Then you have account in a bank or something like that, and then you show yes, we have 1,000 people, we have 2,000. If you get 10,000, then we start production.
Yes, it's democratic production.
Yeah.
It really is. Yes.
Is someone trying something like that?
No, I don't think so. But I think somebody will. I think it is such a good idea that it's impossible that people won't do it.
No.
But I think it's a little too early. All this at the moment, there are a lot of people going around going very surprised. My God, this works. We're doing it. But it's too new still.
Yeah, I think it happened already once, as I noticed it. There was something like an open MPEG car player.
This, oh, yeah,
this
yes.
Linux car player.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they started this way.
Yeah.
They saw.
It's oh, they're doing that. You send what you just kind of vote, and the more votes, if they get enough votes, then they send for a batch to be.
This is our idea. We are working on it, and if you want to have it, just buy it now.
All right.
Excuse me, yeah. Please. The next track should start.
Oh, sorry. Yes. I'll go. Okay. Is it all right? Do you know?
No, I don't need it.
No, but who's it? Do I leave it here? Or?
Ja, gut, aber ich muss 21:10 fährt mir zu.
Oh.
Der letzte nach Berlin. Und, ich habe morgen mehr Veranstaltungen.
Okay.
Okay, but I'm.